Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
This week on The Wheelhouse. The fight for beach access. And a little later, racism in public spaces. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, a show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond right here. It may be winter, cold out there, might I add, but my heart's still in summer. Connecticut residents spend a lot of time on our sandy shoreline every summer, but to get to Hammonasset, to get to Rocky Neck, to get to Sherwood Island, many will jockey for spots on the state's tiny stretches of public beaches. That's because Connecticut's beaches have historically been out of reach to communities of color. Many coastal communities have restricted who can and can't go on their beaches. For more on barriers to beach access, we're joined by
Andrew Carl, the professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia and author of Free the Beaches, The Story of Ned Call, and the Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. Andrew, thank you so much for coming on The Wheelhouse.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew, why have exclusionary beach practices existed in Connecticut for decades?
Well, I mean, they've existed for the same reasons they've existed all around the country. But in Connecticut in particular, you have kind of a combination of, densely populated part of the U.S. alongside great economic inequality and a lot of wealth concentrated along the shoreline that has manifested in exclusionary practices, both in housing markets and in public recreation.
So who exactly gets shut out of our beaches?
Disproportionately, it is racial and ethnic minorities and the poor who do not live in large numbers in many of the communities situated along the shoreline. And so as a result, you have a shoreline that has historically been segregated in all but name.
So you talked about this happening the same reasons as it does in other states. How does Connecticut compare to other states when it comes to, I guess, inclusionary beach access?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why the book is subtitled The Most Exclusive Shoreline, because in many respects, Connecticut state shoreline is really one of the most exclusionary in the country. You see this in many other states in the U.S., but none to the degree to which you see in Connecticut.
Very striking in your book, a quote I learned about, and I'm going to butcher this, but I learned about Jim Crow in Connecticut, not the South. And that, I believe, comes from Ann Petrie, the famous poet from Connecticut.
Yeah. I mean, one of the great Harlem Renaissance novelists and writers. I mean, she, grew up in Old Saybrook. And, as she described, she really experienced Jim Crow for the first time on a beach in Connecticut.
So how do we see this come into play? The exact types of barriers we're talking about here that keep people of color off these beaches historically?
Well, there was two processes that unfolded really beginning in the early 20th century that resulted in, a segregated shoreline by the mid 20th century. And, the first being the proliferation of private beach associations, which were essentially kind of private gated communities were restricted to members only, restricted to people who owned cottages within these areas, and they also had control over their shorelines, which they also restricted to members of those beach associations. Many of these beach associations were founded quite explicitly and placed in their deeds restrictions on the sale of lots to members of the Caucasian race. So these were places that were explicitly, for whites only, and oftentimes, excluded Jews and other disfavored religious and ethnic groups as well. So that, these proliferated along the state shoreline in the early 20th century. But then also you had the growth of public beaches. that were being created by towns along the state shoreline. But these public beaches often placed restrictions on access to residents of those towns only. These were also the same. These same towns often, you know, had pretty exclusionary housing policies. They had very low, in some many cases, you know, zero Black people living in those towns. And then also, thirdly, there was great resistance on the part of these same communities toward this efforts at the state level to create state parks and state beaches. You know, most infamously, there was, you know, great resistance in the 1930s to the creation of Sherwood Park State Park, one of the few state beaches that is available to the general public of Connecticut. So you had all of these sort of unfolding simultaneously and brought us to a point really in the 1950s and 60s when you had, you know, large, you know, African-American populations in cities like New Haven, Bridgeport, and Hartford. And you had a state shoreline that was effectively off limits to the vast majority of the state's African-American and Puerto Rican population.
Just want to zero in on some of the locations here. You talk a lot in this book about the Gold Coast, which is Fairfield County's beaches. But as you mentioned, some of these town beaches that sprung up and these private beach associations, we're talking about as far east maybe as Old Saybrook. I'm thinking about the Fenwick Association.
Absolutely. Fenwick was the first of those beach associations formed in the 1800s. Yeah, I mean, really, it spans from one end of the state to the other. And, you know, these private beach associations are, you know, dot up and down the short state shoreline, still do to this day. And this was definitely a phenomenon that was statewide, although certainly was, you know, perhaps the vigilance in which, you know, towns restricted access was most pronounced on the Gold Coast, for sure.
Today, you have Connecticut lawmakers like Representative Roland Lamar, who have attempted to expand access to beaches recent years. Why do those efforts continue to fail?
I think that there's still a great deal of resistance on the part of many residents within shoreline communities toward the idea of general beach access. I think there's been a kind of a culture of exclusion that has grown up in these towns that still you know, sort of shapes and informs how people think, not just about, you know, the, you know, town beaches, but ultimately how they see the threat of open access. Coupled with that is the power and influence that beachfront homeowners continue to wield, you know, by and large are, you know, pretty you know, wealthy or well-to-do, and can exert a greater degree of political influence than, say, those who are being excluded from the state shoreline. So I think there's, you know, a lot of factors at play here that continue to sort of you know, push against efforts to really truly open up the state shoreline to the general public.
Why is it so divisive?
You know, with a lot of things in the history of race and inequality in America, it could come, you know, it comes down to questions about, you know, sort of the material advantages that, you know, exclusion can provide to those who enjoy its benefits. And also as well, some of the social anxieties that surround, you know, sort of, you know, truly public spaces, places that can actually bring diverse groups of people together, that can sometimes, you know, sort of be seen as threatening and sometimes be seen as dangerous, and other ways can be also not just be, you know, threatening to people's own sort of, you know, sense of safety, but also as well, you know, the their own material investments. Private beaches or, say, town beaches that are exclusive in nature enhance real estate values for property owners and for residents in these communities. I mean, these are assets that these towns and certainly, you know, private beach associations tout and are kind of, you know, factored into the exclusivity of the communities as a whole. And so removing those restrictions is seen as threatening on a whole host of levels, I could imagine.
So you're getting into a lot of the reason of why people would oppose this. And political localism, as I understand it from reading your book, was something that kind of sprung up in the 60s and 70s that really, I guess, proliferated this exclusionary kind of zoning practice that keeps people out. So just help me understand more about opposition. You talked about property values and stuff like that, but how can people continue to oppose, I guess, inclusionary beaches?
Well, certainly, as you mentioned, I mean, I think, you know, this is really the story of the struggle for civil rights in the North in the 1960s and 70s was, you know, these were communities that, you know, there was no fight to tear down Jim Crow signs or to desegregate formally segregated schools in the North, as you saw in the South. But rather, instead, it was you know, a struggle over these ostensibly, you know, race neutral policies that nevertheless had racially disparate effects, and that, you know, was manifest in public school systems, where school district lines were kind of surgically drawn to exclude lower income and minority populations and keep them concentrated within under-resourced schools, and same thing with housing markets where, you know, the removal of formal racial restrictions like, you know, racial covenants, which were declared unenforceable by the, you know, the Supreme Court in 1948, were replaced with instead forms of fiscal zoning and other exclusionary zoning practices that drove up the value of housing markets and at the same time sort of limited the availability of affordable housing options. And this was certainly happening in Connecticut, where you see, you know, many of the wealthiest towns in the state have pretty, you know, extreme measures of, you know, pretty extreme zoning ordinances that really, you know, limit the availability of affordable housing. And so, you know, the fight over open access to public recreational spaces and especially beaches was, you know, a part of that broader struggle.
So in 2001, the Connecticut Supreme Court affirms the right of non-residents to use these municipal beaches. But I take it that that didn't get the job done in terms of making these beaches more inclusive.
I mean, this was an important moment in this longer history in that, you know, this was really the first time that the state Supreme Court had sort of handed down a decision on this matter of whether or not you could have a public beach that was restricted to only a narrow subset of the public. And that's essentially what Greenwich's town beach ordinance did, was it said, you know, this is a town beach, it's a public beach, but yet the only members of the public that are allowed here are residents of Greenwich. And the state Supreme Court said that, no, you couldn't do that. That was unconstitutional. But the decision really left open many other questions, and it still permitted towns to charge fees for using to entering into and accessing town beaches, but and not just, you know, charge fees, but charge fees that are higher for non-residents versus residents. So they left that in place, and that was actually, something that was being practiced by many towns already at the time, in which they didn't have outright bans on non-residents, but they did have higher entrance fees for non-residents, and sometimes much higher, and much higher in a way that they really serve no purpose other than to discourage non-residents from using these beaches. And so that was, once the decision was handed down and the court really left that tool available to towns that wanted to, you know, restrict access to non-residents, then you really saw that sort of those types of measures proliferate. And Greenwich, among many other towns, really leaned heavily on these types of restrictions. You know, make not just higher fees for day passes for non-residents, but also, and sometimes, you know, kind of forcing people who are seeking to use the beach to kind of jump through a variety of hoops.
Mm. Yeah, because you have to have parking basically to or a car to actually access the beach. Is that correct? And just can you just give me an idea of these beach passes, how much they would cost when you're talking about it? Any kind of idea you can. When you're talking about a non-resident versus a resident of the town, how much more it might cost?
Oh, I mean, initially, I don't know how, I haven't kept track of the latest rates, but I know initially they were sometimes, grossly exorbinant, many times more, sometimes, wow. Upwards of, in the hundreds of dollars, even, I believe, in some instances, towns were floating that as a response. But I think, as well, I mean, as you mentioned, parking was another huge issue. And I think, and remains, a real, challenge for people who aren't fortunate enough to live in shoreline towns, who maybe are, living in the state's interior or coming from out of state. Obviously, having access to parking is crucial to being able to actually enjoy these places. And many towns not only raised parking rates for access to lots near beaches, but in some instances actually removed parking spaces entirely. And I should also mention again that these types of tactics are not unique to Connecticut. You see this in many highly exclusive shoreline communities across the country. That these types of measures, like removing general parking, making it expensive and extremely difficult for people who aren't fortunate enough to live near the shore to actually enjoy it.
And now we're getting into the heat of why this is important to talk about this. The right to outdoor recreation. Why is it so essential, Andrew?
Recreation is a human right, one that's been recognized, by the United Nations. I mean, this is something that, we all need to sort of have access to outdoor space. And for not just for our own, personal well-being, but, especially public space plays an integral role in a democratic society, that in many ways, sort of the extent and availability of public space, places that, people can enjoy freely and that bring people of different backgrounds together, is really, that the availability of that, it can be a real, telltale sign of the health of a democratic society as a whole. So it's both important for individuals and for families and for communities to be able to have access to outdoor space and to be able to enjoy common resources. And I think, one thing also I think that I often stress when I talk about this subject is that, especially when it comes to fragile environmental resources like coastlines, which, again, are legally public land. I mean, the public trust doctrine, which is an ancient legal doctrine that has been, incorporated into U.S. common law, treats the shoreline as public land. That's something that nobody can own. It belongs to all of us. And I think there's very good reasons for that being the case. And among the many reasons is that ensuring that this is understood and actually treated as public land is good, not just good social policy, but good environmental policy. And I think that when you privatize something like shorelines, you see over and over again that when private interests dictate the environmental policies surrounding shorelines, that oftentimes they do so in a way that actually degrades and damages the very resources that folks are trying to keep to themselves. And so I think this is something where it doesn't just sort of benefit us as a society and ensuring that everyone enjoys that right to recreation, but also ultimately, especially when it comes to beaches and coastlines, it is crucially important to ensure that these remain something that are in the public's hands and that are something that are treated as a public priority, not just something that is of the interests and prerogatives of private property owners.
You're listening to Andrew Carl, author of Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Call and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. More with Andrew, more on barriers to beach access next. You're listening to The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse. From Connecticut Public Radio, I'm Frankie Graziano. This hour, we're looking at beach access in Connecticut and the history of segregation on our shores. With me is the person who literally wrote the book on this, Andrew Carl, the professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia and author of Free the Beaches, The Story of Ned Call, and The Battle for America's Most Exclusive Shoreline. His name is in the title, Ned Call. Who was Ned Call?
So Ned Call was a social activist from Hartford who in the 1960s founded a private organization that he described as a sort of domestic peace corps that he named Revitalization Corps. And they and this, you know, he was sort of inspired by the words of John F. Kennedy and also by Kennedy's death to essentially, you know, as a young college graduate, he quit his job working for an insurance company in Hartford, took out his life savings and, you know, rented out a storefront in Hartford's North End, which was the heart of the city's African-American community, where he began sort of implementing a variety of measures aimed at addressing poverty and addressing what he saw as this sort of scourge of segregation that was enveloping post-war American life. You know, the flight of white families out to West Hartford into the surrounding suburbs and the increased concentration of poverty and of African Americans within cities. And he wanted to find ways to combat that and also really find outlets for opportunities for African American families, for youth to get the resources that they needed, to get access to the jobs that were leaving the city, to get access to the types of rights that were being denied in this, you know, rapidly resegregating post-war America. And so from there, you know, he, you know, in Revitalization Corps, you know, he worked with a lot of, you know, mostly African-American mothers and women who lived in the North End of Hartford on a variety of different initiatives that really addressed, you know, problems as they arose. And one problem that consistently arose every summer was the fact that Black kids on the North End of Hartford had really nowhere to go. They had their, you know, the city was disinvesting in public recreation. There were few parks or playgrounds available for Black youth. As a result, one of the tragic sort of consequences of this, which was something that was happening, you know, in cities across the country, was there were shockingly high numbers of children who were drowning in rivers and streams and other sort of unsupervised places of play every summer. You know, in the late 1960s, you know, there was a string of drowning deaths, mostly Black children, in the Park River that snakes through Hartford. And, you know, this was a direct result of the fact that the city was not investing in the types of recreational spaces, activities, or programs that underprivileged youth needed. And so out of that, you know, one of the things that, you know, in talking with other parents and talking with, you know, folks in the community, you know, they realized that they needed to have some kind of summer youth program, some way to get kids out of the city, to provide them access to, you know, recreational activities, and to provide them with exposure to different worlds than the ones that they were, you know, living in day to day in these, you know, increasingly, you know, segregated urban environments. And so out of that, you know, one idea that they came up with was, you know, renting some vans and taking some kids down to the shore. Early on, from the, you know, really from the first time they went down to the state shoreline, Ned Call and the volunteers and children who accompanied that, who went on these trips, you know, soon discovered that there were very few places that they could go. The towns that they tried to drive into and, you know, disembark from the van and go, you know, enjoy a day at the beach were not too happy, not too welcoming toward them. And that really turned what had begun as really just a sort of an initiative aimed at trying to get, you know, kids who, you know, to have access to, you know, a day at the beach. It turned it from being just, you know, kind of a charitable sort of measure into what became a cause.
Just want to go back to Ned Call a little bit. This is a white man. It's a white man going to places like Tom's gas station, as I understand it from reading your book, and trying to get Black people of color to join the cause alongside him. How was he met?
So, you know, Ned Call was, again, he was, you know, grew up in a large Irish family in Hartford. He graduated from Fairfield College, later Fairfield University. You know, he was kind of, you know, in many respects, he was destined toward the very life of, you know, a family that would, you know, buy a cottage in a private beach community on the state shoreline. You know, he was kind of that sort of that world of sort of white middle class privilege that he then rebelled against. But, you know, he was someone who, you know, especially in talking to many folks who had sort of worked alongside of him, many of the, you know, African-American mothers and others who, you know, who really got to know him well. I mean, he was someone who many, you know, saw as very genuine, very sincere, and someone who really spent a lot of time getting to know and listening to the concerns of the people in the neighborhoods that he tried to work with and serve. He didn't come in with a sort of a program or a plan that he already had devised in his mind. I mean, he didn't come in really sort of even knowing what the problems were.
Andrew, what's the net result? What happens with Ned Cole and the people that join him to go down to the beaches in these buses? Obviously, they're met with rage and I guess restrictions when they get down there initially, but what's the net result? Does anything come out of this?
So there's a couple of ways you can measure this. One is just by measuring that, like, just the sheer number of children who took part in these trips. And I think one thing that really stood out to me was how, you know, some of the folks who I interviewed and got to know over the course of working on this book mentioned to me that they'd actually didn't know that they were engaging in a protest. They thought they were just going to the beach. And in fact, in a sense, that kind of speaks volumes. I mean, their pleasure was a form of protest. And in fact, you know, the parents who chaperoned these trips and Ned as well, really, you know, they did not tell these kids that they were coming down there to protest something. They said they were going to the beach, and many of them, you know, sort of went there with that in mind. And so it was, in a sense, you know, they were really trying to sort of serve this purpose of getting, you know, children, you know, giving, you know, these types of recreational activities and ensuring that they had those opportunities. So that was one thing, I think, you know, and certainly it changed a lot of minds amongst people in these communities. And I think it can't be, you know, there was no monolithic view on these matters amongst folks living in shoreline towns. And I think that's something that I think really needs to be stressed here, is that, you know, there were many folks in these towns who were uncomfortable with the restrictions on beach access, who tried to welcome Ned Cole and the children who were coming down there, who opened their doors to this organization. They were often overshadowed and, you know, by the much louder and much more vociferous opponents of what Ned Cole and what the Revitalization Corps was aiming to do. But nevertheless, I think it got people talking, and it certainly, you know, opened up, long overdue conversations on the effects of these types of exclusions on those who were being excluded. So that was one element. I think at the same time, it really, you know, it sparked a great deal of controversy, and one that really, in some ways, actually sort of hardened the views of those who opposed more open beach access policies. And so it really kind of put this issue at the forefront of political debates happening within shoreline towns. But it, you know, it's certainly, you know, over time, it really moved this issue to the forefront of the broader sort of public agenda in the state. I mean, this was, you know, became an issue that by the mid to late 70s, you know, the state's governor at the time, Ella Grasso, had to, you know, establish a commission that was aimed at sort of investigating this problem of beach access and trying to find ways to ameliorate it. There was initiatives started to try to expand, you know, sort of, you know, the access to the state's to the state beaches, as well as looking into ways in which the state could acquire more, land along the shoreline. So this was something that, you know, he kind of forced the issue on to into the public's mind in ways that really laid the groundwork for what then ultimately came in 2001, when it was, another person who, you know, challenged this law in court and ultimately won at the highest level.
So is Cole remembered for this action on the beaches, for having Ella Grasso and other people have to pay attention to this issue? Is that how Cole is remembered today?
Oh, I mean, I'm certainly, if anyone who's listening to this right now had known about Ned Cole before before this conversation, they probably knew about him because of the beaches. And I think, you know, that was something that, you know, he drew a lot of attention and drew a lot, made a lot of enemies over the course of the 1970s. I mean, this was ongoing. I mean, he really started this in the early 1970s, and it was throughout the decade. Every summer, he was, you know, bringing kids to shoreline. bringing kids to the beach, but also, I mean, really stepping up protest. I mean, the summer of 1977, he walked from one end of the state shoreline to the other in order to draw attention to the lack of public access to this public resource. And so, he was someone who, generated a lot of controversy. But ultimately as well, I think, was someone who really drew attention to an issue that many folks had, either, weren't aware of or had maybe tried to sort of ignore. And I think that for that, I mean, that was, really a remarkable legacy he left.
Tell me about some of the other people involved in the battle for inclusivity at this time. Tell us about Early Powell. What about Walter Petrie, for example?
Yeah. Oh, Early Powell. What an amazing woman. And I can only sort of, slightly tell. I only tell her story, slightly in this book. But I think, she was someone who was deeply influential on Ned Cole's thinking. She was a mother of children living on the north end of Hartford, African American woman who had worked her whole life and who, was just, dedicated to, her family and to her community in ways that I think, sort of drew her to what Revitalization Corps was doing and, made her a real close ally of Ned Cole throughout his life and throughout her own. Walter Petrie, who you mentioned, he was a professor at Fairfield College. He was of West Indian descent and he, was really on, on the cutting edge of sort of teaching and pedagogy in ways that, you would not often see for, at a college, the college level in the early 1960s. I mean, he was taking groups of students from Fairfield down to Harlem, exposing them to the struggles and triumphs and hardships of residents of underprivileged and disadvantaged communities. He was, exposing Ned Cole, who, again, had grown up in a kind of middle class Irish Catholic neighborhood in Hartford, who had really, not seen poverty or racialized poverty to the extent to which he was, kind of learning about it, firsthand in many ways, those experiences that Ned Cole had as a student of Walter Petrie's would shape him for the rest of his life.
In the absence of government in action, we're seeing private citizens carry on the legacy of Ned Cole's work today, who's currently leading the charge on beach access in Connecticut.
There is a group that formed in the summer of 2020, I believe, and it's called the Connecticut Coastal Public Access Defense. And this group really, formed, I believe the lead organizer is a woman by the name of Catherine Lee Cannon. And she and others, these living in communities like Old Lyme and Old Saybrook and, up and down the state shoreline who like, earlier generations have been really, deeply troubled by the lack of public access and also as well by some of the exclusionary measures that beachfront homeowners employ to keep people off of their beachfront and in doing so and do so in ways that are in direct violation of the law. And so, really trying to sort of challenge these types of measures, both through direct action and through publicity.
Our time together is coming to an end, Andrew, but before we wrap, what can local communities do to reverse the impact of these discriminatory practices? Do you expect towns to right their wrongs?
Certainly you're seeing this today that, you see within shoreline towns, there's no unanimity of opinion. And it really takes those who want to see a more public beach, who want to see, a more diverse community as a whole to speak up and to sort of challenge the measures that are being carried out by town officials and by their neighbors in some instances and doing so really I think a lot of it really can depend on calling attention to the effects that these measures have on everyone who's on the outside looking in. And I think that's something that, if anything, what my story tells and what this, this history sort of teaches us is that the history of exclusion, whether it be in housing markets, whether it be in schools, whether it be in recreational spaces, has really, significant and detrimental effects on those who don't enjoy the advantages that exclusion provides. And so I think, thinking through, what those what those effects are and who they're affecting, and really, you know, sort of taking measures as well to open up public spaces to the general public, to ensure that if you have, you know, sort of public beach, you know, is the public actually using it and can they access it? And I think just to sort of, you know, go back to a point I made earlier is to recognize that these types of measures are not just, you know, sort of good for building a healthier, more diverse community and more democratic society, but in many respects, you know, they're integral to ensuring a more sustainable shoreline environmentally as well. And I think that's, you know, another thing that to sort of think about here in terms of, you know, what is sort of good social policy as well as good environmental policy.
From Connecticut Public Radio, this is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano. Great conversation today with Andrew Carl, author of Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Call and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. Thank you so much for coming on The Wheelhouse, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
So, you've never donated to this station before? That's okay. Public Media Giving Days are a great time to make your first gift. Here's how.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. And all hour, we've been talking about beach access in Connecticut. But there are also barriers to a lot of other public spaces, including parks. In many communities across the United States, public spaces have been transformed into so-called white spaces, whether intentional or not. For more on this, we're joined by Dr. Kung-Jae Lee, assistant professor in the Department of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Management, North Carolina State University. He's actually soon to be an assistant professor of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism at the University of Utah. Dr. Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor, Frankie.
Dr. Lee, you study something called racialized public spaces. Can you explain exactly what that means?
So the idea of racialized space or racialized public space has been around for a long time. W.E.B. Du Bois, he talks about this idea. He didn't use the term racialized space. So I would like to credit Dr. Roger Anderson, who is the Starling Professor of Sociology at Yale University for one of the most rigorous and refined theorization of racialized public space. In his description, the white space or racialized space is basically a perceptual category. This is perception. And it is a space with overwhelming presence of white people or certain racial and ethnic groups. And when people of color enter this space, they feel uneasy, uncomfortable, and feeling out of place. So basically, our society is a collection of various racialized space, and public swimming pools and beaches are a great example, in my opinion. A report from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention showed that Black children are 5.5 times more likely to be drowned compared to white children. Now, why is that? That's not because Blacks are physiologically bad swimmers or anything like that, but because they are not allowed to use public swimming pools and beaches for years, and they had only limited access to them for years, if not centuries, right? Because of racial segregation, Jim Crow, and slavery.
How generally does a white person or unit, like an authority or a beach association, how do they turn something into a racialized public space?
You know, this is not random incident. the distinctive characteristic of racialized public spaces is an overwhelming presence of specific racial and ethnic groups, which creates this exclusionary culture and atmosphere. So this type of numerical dominance does not happen without somebody controlling access to this space. So this is about number, but it's more about social and political control of access. It means that the formation of racialized public space or white space can be understood by the reviewing the history of inclusion and exclusion of certain people from certain space. So we have to review the history.
How are people of color often thought of in these so-called white spaces? You just said the term white space.
When people of color enter the white space, they look around and see if other people of color are there. And if so, they might commute, if not bond. And then they constantly adjust their comfort level and being observant of unfair treatments and judgment. So you have to be constantly on guard. And if it's too much, then you have to go somewhere else, right?
What other kind of impacts does this sort of having to adjust this comfort level, this constant judgment, having to be vigilant in these white spaces, what kind of impact does it have on people of color?
The biggest issue, in my opinion, is health issue. If you look at the literature, public health literature and medical research, stress is a major cause of so many different type of, chronic diseases and health issues. And there has been a rich literature looking at the correlations between stress from racism and then its outcome. I can think of Dr. David Williams. He's a public health researcher at Harvard University. He has an extensive research on this relationship. And think about the stress that people of color have to experience when they are in this white space or other racialized spaces. So we have to be constantly on guard, being observant, and sometimes it's very, very stressful.
Walk us through the history of a little bit of these racialized public spaces. What does the research tell us about the history of American public parks and who they were meant to serve?
Many public parks in the United States are not created for the people, the public, actually. The leaders of public parks and people who were instrumental in nature conservation and preservation movement in the United States, those leaders were very, very rich and influential white individuals who wanted it public parks, not for the benefit of ordinary people, but for their own financial gains through real estate speculation and the benefit of middle and upper class white individuals, people like themselves, basically. So when it comes to community and urban parks, the white ruling class intentionally created certain parks far away from communities of color. And sometimes they even created parks to bulldoze or thriving communities of color. And once parks are created, they impose certain rules and regulations to make sure that park visitors behave in accordance with white upper class cultural norms. So that's the history of community and urban parks. But when it comes to national parks, I mean, national parks are the end results of American imperialism and settler colonialism, right? I mean, Americans basically wiped out the indigenous culture and civilization. And on top of those lands and, national parks are created. So I will say this has been a common pattern until I think this type of oppressive history was very, very common until the late 19th and early 20th century. And then after that, there was a creation of a state park system across the nation. And it was the middle of Jim Crow era. So people of color had not access to very limited access to state parks.
And yeah. Can you continue on there through the Jim Crow era? Earlier in the show, we heard that Jim Crow, mm-hmm. the application of Jim Crow, not just in the South where we would normally kind of associate Jim Crow, but up here is where I talked to you from Connecticut as well, with the poet Ann Petrie talking about experiencing Jim Crow in Connecticut.
One of the biggest misconceptions of a lot of Americans is that Jim Crow this racial segregation applies only in the South. That's not true. If you look at the major cities throughout the United States, Chicago, great example. One of the reasons why Chicago had 1916 race riot was because of the access to public beach, because black boy across the race line in the beach, and then white mobs throw the stone on that, you know, black youth, and he eventually drowned in the water, and that initiate one of the major race riots in Chicago history. So racial segregation, this was very, very common across the nation, and this was either explicit or implicit laws. And when it comes to state parks, the leaders of state parks in this country, they had first national conference on state parks in Des Moines, Iowa, back in 1921. And they came up with this slogan to make public state parks at least 50 miles driving, meaning that all Americans should have access to at least one state park as long as they drive of 50 miles from where they live. Now, their definition of all Americans, we have to ask whose definition of that all American is. I mean, back then, African Americans are treated as second-class citizens. From the get-go, state park provisions, African Americans and other people of color are not perceived to be the major sort of user groups.
Two things as we end here, two questions for you as we end here.
Okay.
Why do all people need to have access to public spaces? Even though that's an obvious question, I want you to help me out with that. And then secondly, what can we do to make these public spaces more inclusive, eliminating this racialized public space? Help me start with the real benefits of spaces like parks.
So the importance of public spaces, including public parks, this is easily noticeable when you think about the benefits that these public spaces provide. Numerical studies, so many empirical evidence have been found on this. Public spaces are essential, very, very important for fostering social cohesion. They promote physical and mental well-being. They signify and express democratic and egalitarian ideals. And public green spaces promote physical activities. And if they are managed well, it promotes environmental sustainability. So when we think about these so many benefits that public spaces provide, this is such a crucial for building healthy, vibrant, and resilient communities. And we all should have access to those benefits because by definition and theoretically, we are paying for these public spaces through taxations. We are funding, we are providing financial support for these spaces, right? And that's why it's so important that we all should have access to public spaces.
So the big question, in order for everybody to have access to these public spaces, what needs to be done? What can we do to eliminate racialized public spaces? Is it even possible?
I will emphasize two things. One is to examine the current condition and whether or not those perception, white space or racialized space, how strongly people feel about that. The prevalence of white spaces or racialized space, we first need to examine that. We have to review the history. We have to talk to local community members. We have to talk to people who actually use those spaces. So once we finish that examination, the next step is to address those issues through various methods. We can enhance access by providing certain incentives, creating intentional programs, diversifying workforce, or intentionally creating, emphasizing the history of people of color or people who have been neglected in that particular space. And those are some of the strategies that I can think of. So it's basically the two-phase process, identifying the issue and then work on the specific strategies depending on the context of that specific space. Because public park spaces are so different across different places. So it needs individualized strategy to address this issue.
Look for some new work to come soon from Dr. Kongjae Lee at the Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Department at the University of Utah. Dr. Lee, thank you so much for joining us on The Wheelhouse.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Today's show produced by Meg Dalton. Thank you so much for putting this together, Meg. Our technical producers are Katie Talarski and Kat Pastor. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano. Thank you for listening.